At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.
What came next is intended for mature audiences only. Episodes discuss topics that can be triggering, such as emotional, physical, and sexual violence, animal abuse, suicide, and murder. I am not a therapist, nor am I a doctor. If you're in need of support, please visit somethingwaswrong.com/resources for a list of nonprofit organizations that can help. Opinions expressed by my guests on the show are their own and do not necessarily represent the views of myself or Broken Cycle Media. Resources and source material are linked in the episode notes. Thank you so much for listening. Mary Garden is a mother, educator, journalist, author, survivor, and advocate from New Zealand. She was born into a family with a great deal of history and many layers of generational trauma that normalized abusive behavior from as early as she can remember. It wasn't until escaping her family home and eventually forging her own family, as well as healing through writing and speaking, that Mary truly began to understand the impact of her journey. The Broken Cycle Media team is so grateful for Mary's advocacy, openness, and grace while discussing the tragedy of ongoing familial and sibling abuse.
My name is Mary Garden. I'm 74 years old. I now live in Victoria, Australia. I was born in New Zealand. The last 17 years, I've actually been working in our family bicycle business with my son. We are importers and distributors of bicycle parts. We are all mad cyclists. It goes right back to my father, who opened one of the first bike shops in Christchurch, which is incredible. Everyone in our family, even my brother, my daughter is now a mountain bike coach. So we've got the cycling gene as well as some other darker genes coming through. I was born in 1950 in New Zealand. Like many other countries in the world, that era was portrayed as a golden age. It definitely was not. Back in the 1950s, the men were mostly head of the household and the women were very powerless. My father was 15 years older than my mother. He had been a very famous pioneer aviator in the 1930s and one of the few that had survived that era, had ended up at the head of Tasman Empire Airways, which became Air New Zealand. After he resigned, he became a tomato grower in Tauranga with my mum and became quite reclusive. My family was very dysfunctional on so many levels. There was some corporal punishment, but certainly not as much as other children of that era received. He was very authoritarian, very stern. We could never talk at the dinner table. My father was so cold. I don't ever remember him touching my mother, hugging her. He would never hug us. I wanted to find out what had happened to him to make him the man he was, so damaged that he damaged others. Going back into his past was quite extraordinary because I found out that his great-grandparents were pioneers in the far north of Scotland in Orkney. My great-grandfather was born into poverty and was illegitimate. He ended up becoming one of the wealthiest merchant traders of North Scotland and Orkney. Some fascinating stories that I see rippling through even into my generation now, that entrepreneurial spirit and resilience, as well as the violence. My grandmother actually ran away from her husband and went into hiding with the four children, which actually helped me understand and have much more compassion for my father. He was very frozen emotionally, carrying a lot of trauma from his childhood. As with many people of that generation, they did not know how to process it. And my mother gave in to him, but she also had this grit. She came from a very interesting family. Someone who interviewed me a few months ago, who actually had worked in the field of social work and had worked with people who'd been abused by siblings or parents, pointed out how lucky I was that I had my mother's family as a sort of buffer to point to you that this is not all there is, that there is light ahead or a better way. Every Christmas, my father was such a loner. He had no friends. He hardly had anyone come over to visit. But every Christmas, Mum took us kids down to the South Island, which is really beautiful, to her parents' home in Westport. It was like going from hell to heaven when I look back on it. And Mum had two older sisters who had no children. So I grew up feeling like I had three mothers. I had one aunt in particular who was very, very kind and loving. I think I was very fortunate to have that. And I was very, very close to Aunt Ola right up to the time she died. I was with her when she died at almost 98. I thought how lucky I was to have a place I could go to where I wasn't running away, hiding or frightened, and had this love. It was like a normal family. Mum never hit us. She was the one who actually stood up to Dad and said, "You're not to hit my children," which was quite extraordinary because it was very common in the 1950s. And my mother was typical of women in those generations. She was very, very depressed. The gift that I did get from my mother, because she was so isolated and so depressed, she was this avid reader. We were introduced to books and magazines. She would order these literary magazines from England and America. So we always had stacks of books by the side of our bed, and she really, really supported us with our schooling. My mother had trained as a nurse. When she met Dad, she was actually working in one of those old-fashioned psychiatric institutions. It was quite barbaric in the 1940s and 50s. It was the era of electric shock treatments and lobotomies. I didn't find out till after her death that she actually was carrying a huge grief that nobody in the family knew about. She had actually given a son away for adoption in 1944. I heard about that 2 months after she died. So even though we're born into this cascade of what they call intergenerational trauma, grief and guilt, there were other things coming through as well. Very early on in my childhood, we all knew there was something wrong with my younger sister. I have an older brother, 11 months older than me. I was the middle child. Early on, they suspected that Anna, the sister, almost 2 years younger than me, might have a mental illness, but there was no way in the world that they would have sought expert help. The headmaster actually called Mum and Dad up to school one day and said, "We're very worried about Anna." He begged them to take Anna to see a psychiatrist, but they refused, and Mum took Anna down to Westport for weeks and left me at home. I was only about 8 or 9. She left me there as the housewife. I was in charge of looking after Dad, cooking, cleaning. The second house we moved into only had 2 bedrooms. My brother was given the bedroom in the house, and about 100 yards away from the house was this old wooden, not insulated, they called them army huts. Mum and Dad stuck Anna and I out there. At the time, we thought this was absolutely incredible. We felt like little grown-ups in our own house. But it turned out to be absolutely terrifying, especially when there were storms. My sister, at a very early age, started venting her rage, her frustration. I was a target, and sometimes mum. When we were sleeping in that hut, I'd be woken up in the middle of the night with my sister scratching me, biting me. I'd be screaming, and Dad would run down the path. And every time he said, "What have you done to upset Anna?" I don't remember my brother hitting me till I was about 11 or 12. He started punching me on my upper arms, and he would punch mum. We would have bruises on our upper arms, which my school uniform would hide. Mum would say, "Mary, he has to let out his frustration on someone." So I just had to put up with it. In my high school years, for 1 year, I was sent up to Auckland to stay with my aunt. Anna had already been there a year. My aunt worked full time, so I was again put in the role as the housekeeper. I was at this private girls' school. I was very unhappy there. I was doing the cooking, the housework, looking after Anna. I came home from school one day and went into her room to see how she was. She just screamed at the top of her voice, told me to get out. As I was walking out the door, I felt something go into my back. It was the long prong of a compass. It had actually lodged right into my spine. I remember asking Anna to call an ambulance, and she didn't. She just crawled into her bed and sulked. I remember stumbling over the road to a neighbour and sitting in that car, hunched over, blood pouring down my back, and this neighbour rushing me into hospital and hearing the doctor saying she's been stabbed. What was the response of my aunt and my mother and my father to that? Because I thought, oh, they're going to feel sorry for me now. What did you do to upset Anna? So again, I got blamed. I learnt at a very early age that it was my fault if I was abused. And that pattern, called repetition compulsion, unconsciously repeated itself right through my life until the 1990s. I think with sibling abuse too, the family's dysfunctional as it is. There's already family violence or intimate partner violence going on. They normalise it. My mother and father would not have wanted to have reported it because of the consequences and the shame around it. Mum and Dad were just struggling to cope with their own lives. So I just thought that is like a second wound when you are abused by a sibling and the parent does not support you. We say that parents do the best they can with what they've got, and certainly they had their own baggage of trauma, but they were incompetent parents in many respects, and they left me to look after Anna very early on. That was my job, to look after my younger sister. So very unhealthy, toxic family environment to grow up in. I left school and went to university at 16. Still a child, completely financially independent from my parents, to go to teachers' college and university. I had 4 years at university. We were all a very overachieving family. My sister was considered the brains of the family. She was very intelligent. I was actually very anxious, too scared to speak up in class. But I went out and had a good time. I had a boyfriend for 1 year, quite a healthy relationship. What I didn't remember, one of my girlfriends from uni who was flatting near me in Auckland got in touch to say she had worried about me over the years, what had happened to Mary. She remembered my sister ringing me all the time, wanting to kill herself. I would go over to my friend so distressed and not knowing what to do. I actually hadn't remembered that till my friend reminded me that I had this burden of my sister. But by the third year, I started to feel depressed. The word depression was not around growing up in the 1960s. I don't even think there was a category of depression. I did not know what was happening with me. And it was almost like all this trauma and pain and abuse that I'd been carrying and hadn't been able to heal or process caught up with me. I didn't know what was happening to me. I ended up dropping out of that university and going up to Auckland, and it sort of followed me. The 60s was quite an exciting time in New Zealand. The counterculture and the Beatles, we thought the world was changing. I think by the early 70s, disillusionment began to set in, which is why thousands and thousands of us headed off to India. We'd grown up with these very authoritarian fathers and put ourselves in relationships with gurus, seeking freedom, but were even more authoritarian than what we had escaped. So it was quite ironic. I was out to look for my true guru and find enlightenment. I had been at university at Auckland and had this strange experience at an ashram and decided to give away my possessions and head off to India. I was a prime target to be caught up in a religious cult. I was abused by this yogi in the Himalayas. I had a late-term coerced abortion. I could have lost my life. I came back from India in 1979. The worst thing that happened with my sister was after I had come back from India, I had settled in Australia, Brisbane. I got a letter from her, which unfortunately I burnt, begging me for help. She said she wanted to kill herself. And because I'd been to India and was connected to God, she knew I could help her. It was just before I had my first child. It was 1980. Now, by that time, Anna was in London. She had a master's degree. She ended up having this incredible academic career in London and also Boston. But here she was writing this letter to me on the other side of the world. I wrote back saying I couldn't help her. I was recovering from being in India. I didn't believe in God anymore. And with no ill will, I suggested she see a psychiatrist. I got back the most vile, vexatious, nasty letter telling me I was the reason her life was such a torture. It was a long, long letter. It was absolutely devastating. And she cut me off. I sent the letter over to Mum and Dad, hoping they would get help for her. No feedback at all. I got blamed again. And so for 7 years, I was absolutely devastated trying to reconnect with my sister, beating myself up, blaming myself. I'd never been a writer. I think I almost failed English literature at university. I never had this dream as a child of being an author. My dream as a child was to be a mother. How lucky am I? I was pregnant with my son, looking for something to do to fill in time. And I thought, oh, I think I'll go to this short story course in Brisbane at night. It was 1 hour for 4 weeks. On the third night, I think I almost dropped out. I thought it was so boring. We had to write a short story, and I could not think of anything to write about except something that had happened in India. So I wrote that story, pretended it was fiction, and the writing instructor wrote on his feedback, "This is exceptionally well written. I think you should write a full-length book on your experiences. I think that would have a wide readership." And I was absolutely flabbergasted. Nobody had ever praised any of my writing in my life. But I wasn't ready to write my story then. I had only been 2 years out of India and I was about to be a new mum. But those words haunted me for years. Occasionally I would write things out and put them in a bottom drawer. It was almost like that story was waiting to be told. So it was 1987. I'd started writing this story and it just poured out of me. I'd be waking Kevin up at night, reading bits out to him. And the very interesting thing about writing that book is that there had been no story published anywhere in the world, to my knowledge, shining a light on the abuse that was going on in these cults with various gurus. As I was writing it, and especially that chapter on this abortion in that dingy Delhi hospital, I thought, oh my God, this is horrific. I suddenly realized that what I had been through was horrendous. So that was the power of writing The Serpent Rising, A Journey of Spiritual Seduction, which was based on my years in India. And when it was finished, I didn't have her address. Mum sent Anna a copy of the book. I actually naively thought my book would help heal things. I got a letter from her Luckily, I kept that letter of my sister's. I sent that letter to Mum and Dad and to my half-sister. I got no validation. I thought there was something wrong with me for having such a strong reaction to that letter. Somebody who interviewed me a few months ago mentioned it and just said, "What toxic horror. I'm so sorry, Mary." I cried when she said that. There's definitely something wrong with my sister to have written a letter like that. But in some ways, the letter was a gift because I ended up deciding I actually wanted no contact with her at all. When that book came out, even though the book was slightly therapeutic, I had not done any healing work or got any help. The media attention was re-traumatizing. The book came out and I was on this major television station midday show. I remember Ray Martin saying to me, "Do you think there was something wrong with you that you went off and got caught up with these cults?" I mean, that's a horrifying thing to say. And then there were all these sensationalized articles in newspapers. I ended up after a year feeling so ashamed of writing that book. I had moved to a sort of artistic alternative community. And I remember one of the community leaders saying to me, "I don't know why you wrote that book, because so many people go to India and have fantastic time." I thought, what have I done? I shouldn't have written this story. There's something wrong with me. But it was only some years later that all these stories started coming to light and someone said, "Mary, you need to write that book again." So The Serpent Rising, first published in 1988, a new edition in 2003, and then it actually won an award in 2021, and I keep getting interviewed about it. In a way, I was lucky I self-published it because it might have been just dead in 1988. And even though the first few years was quite re-traumatizing, the way the media didn't know how to handle this strange story, I'm still having people write emails and messages of just read your book or listen to your podcast, and it just resonated so much. It was 1990, I had published this book. I'd had two children. My marriage had been quite reasonable for 10 years. Kevin and I were really good friends, but in many ways I'd married my father. Kevin was 15 years older than me, and he was authoritarian. He was quite controlling. And he felt very threatened when I had published this book. That marriage ended and he turned on me. They talk about the post-separation abuse. I left that marriage and ended up, I thought, with the love of my life, who turned out to be a psychopath. I was only with that man for 1 year. That was when I realized I need help. This pattern is coming right through from my childhood. That was when I started unpacking my life. So in some ways, those awful relationships were a gift, ironically enough, because I realized I needed to go and get some therapy. I was very, very lucky to be introduced to the work of Elizabeth Kubler-Ross. I never met her, but she trained doctors and she used to do these externalization of emotions workshops. They were very different from many of the new age therapies that I had dabbled in the last few years in India. There was always a medical doctor. And this was the first time in my life that I actually got in touch with all my repressed emotions. This therapy is not for everyone, and I certainly don't do it now. But I got in touch with the concept of the inner child, that inner Mary, the one that had never been believed or protected or listened to. I ended up doing a number of these workshops. It was quite a revelation to do that work. I think by the end of a decade, a few psychologists have actually said to me, "Mary, I think you should just go and write, sort things out and make sense of things with your writing." After The Serpent Rising was published, a magazine called Nature and Health got in touch with me and said, "We want you to write a feature article on mind control and cults." That was 1991. So I wrote this feature article. I didn't know how to write a feature article. And I remember getting this big fat check in the mail and I thought, oh my God, that beats writing books. I had this germinating in my mind for the rest of that decade, oh, I'd love to be a freelance journalist. That Christmas, my son bought me up a book by Stephen King called On Writing. I read that and I thought, I am going to become a freelance journalist. I'm going to do what Stephen King says. I'm going to just shut the door, sit at my desk and write. By the end of 6 months, I had a feature article published in one of Australia's major, major newspapers, centrefold. I was just on an absolute roll. I had completely consciously cut off from my sister for a long time. After Dad died in 1997, she was wealthy, living in London, and she went missing for 2 years. She ended up having a complete breakdown and sold all her possessions, used up all her money, flying around the world, following some of the paths my father had flown. Christmas 2000, I get a call from my mother to say, Anna has been picked up on the street of Napier, which is a town in New Zealand. She's homeless. She'd been crawling up trees and she's been admitted to a mental health unit. I subsequently found out that she'd been needing help all the way through. Mum had been flying over to Boston and flying over to England when Anna was suicidal and she never got professional help. Mum thought it was her job to help Anna, even though Anna was quite abusive to Mum. From the year 2000 to the year 2007, Anna started living with Mum. She wouldn't go and get social security help. She had no income. So she was financial abuse of Mum. She was physically violent to Mum. It was an absolute nightmare for Mum. Anna would be sectioned for short periods of time, and because she was so clever and articulate, they would release her out into the community. Mum would have to run away from her and hide, stay in hotels and motels just to get a little break from her. I went over in 2005 to help Mum move house, and Anna attacked me in public. I was with my mum and my aunt Ola, and a man came running down the road to help. We had to go to the police and the mental health services came. What happened? Nothing. Anna told the mental health crisis team that I had provoked her. The local policeman said to me, Mary, you can take legal action against your sister, a civil case, but aren't you lucky you live in Australia? Go back there and forget your family. Ironically, that was a complete turning point with my mum and Ola in relationship to my sister, because up to then, there was always this shame. Why don't you get along with your sister? Why can't you be friends with your sister? From that point on, my mum and my aunt had my back. It was a bit later in my life, mind you. I was, 55? So it had to be an assault in public that they witnessed. They saw that I had done absolutely nothing to provoke my sister. I was quite traumatised from that assault and saw a psychiatrist in Bundaberg who said I had post-traumatic stress disorder from that and my whole life, actually. It was in 2007 that we actually got the help for my sister. She's 55. She was finally sectioned for a lengthy period of time and diagnosed with schizoid affective disorder. That's mainly schizophrenia with bipolar. By that time, Mum was elderly then and had been sick. We had to put her in a nursing home. And I thought, what a wretched tale. I never thought I would write another book. Some years after my father died, there had been talk about someone writing a book about Dad, but we thought it's too late now. He's dead. He's left no diaries. There's hardly any letters. And I wrote this feature article called Sundowner of the Skies, Mary Garden Takes Flight with Her Father. The reaction to that article was unbelievable. Emails from people everywhere wanting to know more about Oscar. Can you please write a book? That started a long journey of me writing this book about my father. That article was published in 2005. Sundowner of the Skies, the story of Oscar Garden, a forgotten aviator. That was published in 2019. When the book came out, even though the publisher had wanted to aim at the aviation readers and the aviation market, whenever I gave talks, even people who were aviation enthusiasts wanted to know more about the family dysfunction. The publisher's editor had actually asked me to cut out a lot of the original manuscript. There were like 10,000 words left out, which she said, oh, that's a new book. And that was quite a bit of detail about my sister and things that happened after my father died. I took a big break in between because I thought it's too hard. Went and did a PhD at university. I ended up going to university to do an editing degree and somehow ended up doing a PhD in journalism. I ended up at the end of doing that PhD thinking, if I can write an 80,000 word thesis, then I'm going to finish this book on my father. I sat down last January. I had not planned to write this book. It just came pouring out of me. It wasn't difficult to write. It wasn't upsetting. I just was hours and hours at my computer, and within 6 weeks I had this rough draft. I was waking up in the night just writing things down. It was so astonishing. My sister was still alive and I'd had no contact with her. While I was writing it, I was thinking, what are you doing, Mary? You can't publish this book. Anna's still alive. But I was compelled to get this story out. I think writing can heal the brain, and writing is a way of getting rid of shame. I had finished the first draft and had even sent sections off to get a manuscript appraisal, and I got an email from my brother to say that Anna had been admitted to hospital with severe psychosis. They'd now discovered she had Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease, which is terminal. I could not believe it, mainly because of the assault, the way she attacked me in Auckland in 2005. I have had this fear that my sister could kill me. The minute I got that news that Anna was dying, I felt shocked and sad, but I felt a huge relief. The beauty about writing this current book, My Father's Suitcase, I started writing it feeling quite angry towards my sister. But by the time I reached the end of the book, I felt like this deep compassion because I realised she had had such a struggle through her life and hadn't got the support she needed. I certainly don't forgive her. The only person I have to forgive is me. The only person I really need to feel compassion for is the little Mary that was wounded and the Mary who was assaulted. That's the person I need to feel deep compassion for. That abuse was almost enabled by a whole society. It was enabled by my parents, my aunt, teachers, the mental health unit. So I think while I was writing My Father's Suitcase, I found myself increasingly angry about those who stood by and didn't help me and blamed me, the bystanders. That's what writing can do, especially memoir. You can get new insights, and I got new insights about my brother. So I encourage everyone just to write. It doesn't matter if it's published or not, but writing out your story can be so therapeutic and so illuminating, quite powerful stuff. The original title of my book was A Stab in the Back, A Memoir on Sibling Abuse, but we came up with My Father's Suitcase, a story of family secrets, abuse, betrayal, and breaking free. Because suitcase is a metaphor for emotional baggage, psychological baggage. And it was mostly my father's trauma we were born into. It was published in May this year. My book is available on Amazon as both a print book and an ebook. The audio book should be available in a few days. 3 years ago, I would never, ever have imagined writing a book about sibling abuse. Sibling abuse is the same way we'd define any other type of abuse. It's targeted abuse. It's an abuse of power. It's actually a very serious form of abuse that has long-term emotional and psychological and mental health consequences. I knew my sister had been violent to me, but I literally did not know there was this term, a category of abuse called sibling abuse. We've got intimate partner violence, we've got elder abuse, parent-child abuse, and sibling abuse. That was such a revelation to me. It is under research, but there is a body of research around sibling abuse. It is such an important topic. I think it's the missing piece of family violence policy. Through this book, I'm not just writing my story of my relationship with my sister in the context of our very dysfunctional birth family. I'm also drawing on research and occasionally mentioning other people's experiences and stories. Now I can tell this story, which isn't just my story. I was writing this story for all those people in the world, and there's millions of them, the silent victims of sibling abuse. The person whose feedback I was most concerned about wasn't my daughter, Natalia, because she did not want to know about my book last year. She only read the book when it came out. I had deliberately left her out of some chapters, and she said it just moved her so much. She said she felt really sad at the end, but it put everything in perspective. It sort of put this big jigsaw together. And she said, I can't believe you were so friendly with your brother for so long. So that was very validating as well. She loved it. She said it was really powerful. The most incredible thing in the last few months as I've been touring around giving talks about my book, I had a photographer. They came to my house to do this photo shoot, and the assistant started crying. She said, I didn't know there was this thing called sibling abuse. My brother used to beat me up, and his wife has now taken out a domestic violence order. So the number of people who've had these aha moments, oh my God, that happened to me. I didn't think it actually damaged me, but now the more I think about it, I think it's had a huge impact on my life. In contrast to the terrible shaming experience I had with my first book, with this one, The Suitcase, 95% has been absolutely fantastic. But there's been the odd one. There was one interview I did at a book event. What this interviewer did, which is really gaslighting, the very first thing she said, I got on well with my brother. And I thought, what's that got to do with anything? That is shaming me. You wouldn't say to a victim of domestic violence, oh, well, I had a great relationship with my husband. And then all through the interview, we were sitting in front of this crowd. She was clutching my wrist, urging me to go into all the details of the abuse. I unconsciously found myself being quite disempowered. I'm very frustrated with the discussions at the moment in the media about family violence. If you do a Google search, there's hardly anything written about sibling abuse. I've found a few articles where your book has been written about and sibling abuse, but not here in Australia. And I'm thinking, oh my God, this is incredible. I did talk about repetition compulsion. I certainly found that pattern in childhood. I can't help but wonder, being a victim of sibling abuse and repeating that pattern in adult relationships, how many of those perpetrators who aren't called out and who aren't challenged grow up to be perpetrators of intimate partner abuse? There has been some research which shows there is some relationship that does happen. We really have to start talking about this issue. We have to put the focus on our healing instead of just focusing on the acts of abuse. We have to be very gentle with ourselves. The wounds are always going to be with us. We've just got to enlarge our lives around it and honour that part of us that's the child that's been hurt, that's not going to go away. I think art therapy is a fantastic modality. I'm a huge believer in exercise. That was one little gift I got from growing up in the Mad Garden household in New Zealand. We were very active. I love cycling and going out on long bike rides, just getting the body moving. I did this course on Zen meditation called Zen Meditation Walking, to walk in silence and feel the sensation of your foot as it touches the ground. I just find that is the perfect meditation for someone like me who's very active. So there's all sorts of things people can do, but journaling and therapy and reading memoirs. I think memoirs are so powerful. It's my favorite genre. I love reading memoirs because it makes you feel less alone.
There's so many facets of your journey that spoke to me personally, and I know will speak to the audience of the show. I just appreciate everything you give to the world to try to better society.
Thank you. My website is easy to find, marygarden.com.au. I'm on Twitter, not so often these days, Instagram, Facebook, LinkedIn. I feel very honored that you agreed to have this conversation.
Thank you so much for listening to today's episode. Next week on What Came Next.
She was a good person. She was so sweet and kind, sassy and funny. She definitely did not deserve to be murdered. No one does. And she definitely has not deserved to be used and abused publicly for the last 12 years. I do hope that I'm able to get her some type of justice so that people stop doing that to her without permission.
What Came Next is a Broken Cycle Media production co-produced by Amy B. Chesler and Tiffany Reese. If you'd like to help support What Came Next, you can leave us a positive review, support our sponsors, or follow Broken Cycle Media on Instagram at Broken Cycle Media. Check out the episode notes for sources, resources, and to follow our guests. Thank you again for listening.